was a mere make-believe. It could not administer justice. But even those privileges to which the accused were legitimately and legally entitled could not be given to the accused in political cases. We wanted to make the government throw off its veil and to be candid enough to admit that fair chances for defense could not be given to the political accused. Here we have the frank admission of the government. We congratulate you, as well as your government, for this candor and welcome the ordinance. In spite of the frank admission of your agents, the special magistrate and the prosecution counsels, as to the reasonableness of our attitude throughout, you had been confused at the very thought of the existence of our case. What else is needed to assure us of our success in this fight? Chapter 12. Letter to Jaydev Gupta, 24th July 1930. Bhagat Singh requested his close friend from school to send over some books for him. Let me announce with all the strength at my command that I am not a terrorist, and I never was, except perhaps in the beginning of my revolutionary career. And I am convinced that we cannot gain anything through those methods. Bhagat Singh. Lahore Central Jail, 24th July 1930. My dear Jaydev, please take following books in my name from Dwarkadas Library and send them through Kulveer on Sunday. Militarism, Karl Liebknecht. Why Men Fight, B. Russell. Soviets at Work, Collapse of the Second International. Left-Wing Communism, Mutual Aid, Prince Kropotkin. Fields, Factories and Workshops. Civil War in France, Marx. Land Revolution in Russia, Spy, Upton Sinclair. Please send one more book from Punjab Public Library, Historical Materialism by Bukharin. Also, please find out from the librarian if some books have been sent to Borstal Jail. They are facing a terrible famine of books. They had sent a list of books through Sukhdev's brother Jaydev. They have not received any book till now. In case they have no list, then please ask Lala Firoz Chand to send some interesting books of his choice. The books must reach them before I go there on this Sunday. This work is a must. Please keep this in mind. Also send Punjab Peasants in Prosperity and Debt by Darling and two or three books of this type for Dr. Alam. Hope you will excuse me for this trouble. I promise I will not trouble you in future. Please remember me to all my friends and convey my respect to Lajjavati. I am sure if Dutt's sister came, she will not forget to see me. With regards, Bhagat Singh. Chapter 13. For the Removal of Justice Hilton, 25th June 1930. The presiding judge on the Lahore conspiracy case lost his temper during the proceedings and got the accused handcuffed and sent back to jail. As retaliation, Bhagat Singh asked for the judge to be removed. On 21st June, the presiding judge was removed, but instead of the next senior judge, who was sympathetic towards the accused, Justice Hilton was appointed in his place, who was a party to the order. The accused objected to it, and Bhagat Singh wrote this letter. I never had any desire to defend myself, and never did I seriously think about it. Bhagat Singh. To the Commissioner, the Special Tribunal, Lahore Conspiracy Case, Lahore. Sir, whereas two judges of the tribunal have withdrawn or have been made to withdraw themselves from the tribunal, and two new judges have been appointed in their place, we feel that a statement is very necessary on our part to explain our position clearly so that no misunderstanding may be possible. It was on 12th May 1930 that an order was passed by Mr. Justice Coldstream, the then president, to handcuff us. In asking the court to inform us as to the cause of this sudden and extraordinary order was not thought worth consideration. The police handcuffed us forcibly and removed us back to jail. One of the three judges, Mr. Aga Haridhar, on the following day disassociated himself with that order of the president. Since that day, we have not been attending court. Our condition on which we were prepared to attend court was laid before the tribunal on the next day, namely that either the president should apologize or he should be replaced. By this we never meant that a judge who was a party to that order should take the place of the president. For more than 5 weeks, no heed was paid to the grievances of the accused. According to the present formation of the tribunal, both the president and the other judge, who had disassociated himself from the order of the president, have been replaced by two new judges. Thus the judge, who was a party to that order, as the president gave the order on behalf of the majority, has now been appointed the president of the tribunal. In these circumstances, we want to emphasize one thing, that we had absolutely no grudge against the person of Mr. Justice Coldstream. We had protested against the order passed by the president on behalf of the majority, and the subsequent maltreatment meted out to us. We have every respect for Mr. Justice Coldstream and Mr. Justice Hilton that should be expected from man to man. And as our protest was against a certain order, we wanted the president to apologize, which meant apology by the president on behalf of the tribunal who was responsible for that order. By the removal of the president, the position is not changed, because Mr. Justice Hilton, who was a party to the order, is presiding in place. Position has added an insult to injury. Yours, etc., Bhagat Singh, B.K. Dutt. Chapter 14. Letter to B.K. Dutt, November 1930. After the death sentence was pronounced for him, he wrote down his feelings to his comrade. "I will climb the gallows gladly, and show to the world as to how bravely the revolutionaries can sacrifice themselves for the cause." Bhagat Singh. Central Jail, November 1930. "Dear brother, the judgment has been delivered. I am condemned to death. In these cells, besides myself, there are many other prisoners who are waiting to be hanged. The only prayer of these people is that somehow or other they may escape the noose. Perhaps I am the only man amongst them who is anxiously waiting for the day when I will be fortunate enough to embrace the gallows for my ideal. I will climb the gallows gladly and show to the world as to how bravely the revolutionaries can sacrifice themselves for the cause. I will be condemned to death, but you are sentenced to transportation for life. You will live, and while living, you will have to show to the world that the revolutionaries not only die for their ideals, but can face every calamity. Death should not be a means to escape the worldly difficulties. Those revolutionaries who have by chance escaped the gallows for the ideal, but also bear the worst type of tortures in the dark, dingy prison cells. Yours, Bhagat Singh." Chapter 15. To Young Political Workers, 2nd February 1931. After Bhagat Singh's execution, this document was published in a mutilated form. All references to Soviet Union, Marx, Lenin, and the Communist Party were carefully deleted. Subsequently, the Government of India published it in one of its secret reports in 1936. "Study was the cry that reverberated in the corridors of my mind. Study to enable yourself to face the arguments advanced by opposition. Study to arm yourself with arguments in favor of your cult. I began to study." Bhagat Singh. To the Young Political Workers. "Dear comrades, our movement is passing through a very important phase at present. After a year's fierce struggle, some definite proposals regarding the constitutional reforms have been formulated by the Roundtable Conference, and the Congress leaders have been invited to give this. Think it desirable in the present circumstances to call off their movement. Whether they decide in favor or against is a matter of little importance to us. The present movement is bound to end in some sort of compromise. The compromise may be effected sooner or later. And compromise is not such ignoble and deplorable a thing as we generally think. It is rather an indispensable factor in the political strategy. Any nation that rises against the oppressors is bound to fail in the beginning, and to gain partial reforms during the medieval period of its struggle through compromises. And it is only at the last stage, having fully organized all the forces and resources of the nation, that it can possibly strike the final blow in which it might succeed to shatter the ruler's government. But even then it might fail, which makes some sort of compromise inevitable. This can be best illustrated by the Russian example. In 1905, a revolutionary movement broke out in Russia. All the leaders were very hopeful. Lenin had returned from the foreign countries where he had taken refuge. He was conducting the struggle. People came to tell him that a dozen landlords were killed and a score of their mansions were burned. Lenin responded by telling them to return and to kill 1,200 landlords and burn as many of their palaces. In his opinion, that would have meant something if revolution failed. Duma was introduced. The same Lenin advocated the view of participating in the Duma. This is what happened in 1907. In 1906, he was opposed to the participation in this first Duma, which had granted more scope of work than the second one, whose rights had been curtailed. This was due to the changed circumstances. Reaction was gaining the upper hand, and Lenin wanted to use the floor of the Duma as a platform to discuss socialist ideas. Again, after the 1917 revolution, when the Bolsheviks were forced to sign the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, everyone except Lenin was opposed to it. But Lenin said, "Peace. Peace and again peace. Peace at any cost, even at the cost of many of the Russian provinces to be yielded to German warlord." When some anti-Bolshevik people condemned Lenin for this treaty, he declared frankly that the Bolsheviks were not in a position to face German onslaught, and they preferred the treaty to the complete annihilation of the Bolshevik government. The thing that I wanted to point out was that compromise is an essential weapon which has to be wielded every now and then as the struggle develops. But the thing that we must keep always before us is the idea of the movement. We must always maintain a clear notion as to the aim for the achievement of which we are fighting. That helps us to verify the success and failures of our movements, and we can easily formulate the future program. Tilak's policy, quite apart from the ideal, that is, his strategy, was the best. You are fighting to get 16 annas from your enemy. You get only one anna. Pocket it and fight for the rest. What we note in the moderates is of their ideal. They start to achieve one anna and they can't get it. The revolutionaries must always keep in mind that they are striving for a complete revolution, complete mastery of power in their hands. Compromises are dreaded because the conservatives try to disband the revolutionary forces after the compromise from such pitfalls. We must be very careful at such junctures to avoid any sort of confusion of the real issues, especially the goal. The British labor leaders betrayed their real struggle and have been reduced to mere hypocrite imperialists. In my opinion, the die-hard conservatives are better to us than these polished imperialist labor leaders. About the tactics and strategy, one should study life work of Lenin. His definite views on the subject of compromise will be found in left-wing communism. I have said that the present movement, that is, the present struggle, is bound to end in some sort of compromise or complete failure. I said that because, in my opinion, this time the real revolutionary forces have not been invited into the arena. This is a struggle dependent upon the middle-class shopkeepers and a few capitalists. Both these, and particularly the latter, can never dare to risk its property or possessions in any struggle. The real revolutionary armies are in the village and in factories, the peasantry and the laborers. But our bourgeois leaders do not and cannot dare to tackle them. The sleeping lion, once awakened from its slumber, shall become irresistible, even after the achievement of what our leaders aim at. After his first experience with the Ahmedabad laborers in 1920, Mahatma Gandhi declared, "We must not tamper with the laborers. It is dangerous to make political use of the factory proletariat." The Times, May 1921. Since then, they never dared to approach them. There remains the peasantry. The Bardoli resolution of 1922 clearly denies the horror the leaders felt when they saw the gigantic peasant class rising to shake off not only the domination of an alien nation, but also the yoke of the landlords. It is there that our leaders prefer a surrender to the British than to the peasantry. Leave alone Pandit Jawaharlal. Can you point out any effort to organize the peasants or the laborers? No, they will not run the risk. There they lack. That is why I say they never meant a complete revolution. Through economic and administrative pressure, they hoped to get a few more reforms, a few more concessions for the Indian capitalists. That is why I say that this movement is doomed to die. Maybe after some sort of compromise or even without. The young workers who in all sincerity raised the cry Inqilab Zindabad are not well organized and strong enough to carry the movement themselves. As a matter of fact, even our great leaders, with the exception of perhaps Pandit Motilal Nehru, do not dare to take any responsibility on their shoulders. That is why every now and then they surrender unconditionally before Gandhi. In spite of their differences, they never oppose him seriously, and the resolutions have to be carried for the Mahatma. In these circumstances, let me warn the sincere young workers who seriously mean a revolution that harder times are coming. Let them beware, lest they should get confused or disheartened. After the experience made through two struggles of the great Gandhi, we are in a better position to form a clear idea of our present position and the future program. Now allow me to state the case in the simplest manner. You cry, "Long live the revolution." Let me assume that you really mean it. According to our definition of the term, as stated in our statement in the assembly bomb case, revolution means the complete overthrow of the existing social order and its replacement with the socialist order. For that purpose, our immediate aim is the achievement of power. As a matter of fact, the state, the government machinery, is just a weapon in the hands of the ruling class to further and safeguard its interest. We want to snatch and handle it to utilize it for the consummation of our ideal basis. That is social reconstruction on new, that is Marxist. For this purpose, we are fighting to handle the government machinery. All along, we have to educate the masses and to create a favorable atmosphere for our social program. In the struggles, we can best train and educate them. With these things clear before us, that is our immediate and ultimate object having been clearly put, we can now proceed with the examination of the present situation. We must always be very candid and quite businesslike while analyzing any situation. We know that since a hue and cry was raised about the Indians' participation in and share in the responsibility of the Indian government, the Minto Morley reforms were introduced, which formed the Viceroy's Council with consultation rights only. During the Great War, when the Indian help was needed the most, promises about self-government were made and the existing reforms were introduced. Limited legislative powers have been entrusted to the Assembly, but subject to the goodwill of the Viceroy. Now is the third stage. Now reforms are being discussed and are to be introduced in the near future. How can our young men judge them? This is a question. I do not know by what standard are the Congress leaders going to judge them, but for us, the revolutionaries, we can have the following criteria. 1. Extent of responsibility transferred to the shoulders of the Indians. 2. From the government institutions that are going to be introduced and the extent of the right of participation given to the masses. 3. Future prospects and the safeguards. These might require a little further elucidation. In the first place, we can easily judge the extent of responsibility given to our people by the control our representatives will have on the executive. Up till now, the executive was never made responsible to the Legislative Assembly, and the Viceroy had the veto power, which rendered all the efforts of the elected members futile. Thanks to the efforts of the Swaraj Party, the Viceroy was forced every now and then to use these extraordinary powers to shamelessly trample the solemn decisions of the national representatives underfoot. It is already too well known to need further discussion. Now, in the first place, we must see the method of the executive formation. Whether the executive is to be elected by the members of a popular assembly or is to be imposed from above as before, and further, whether it shall be responsible to the House or shall absolutely affront it as in the past. As regards the second item, we can judge it through the scope of franchise. The property qualifications making a man eligible to vote should be altogether abolished and universal suffrage be introduced instead. Every adult, both male and female, should have the right to vote. At present, we can simply see how far the franchise has been extended. I may here make a mention about provincial autonomy, but from whatever I have heard, I can only say that the governor imposed from above, equipped with extraordinary powers higher and above the legislative, shall prove to be no less than a despot. Let us better call it the provincial tyranny instead of autonomy. This is a strange type of democratization of the state institutions. The third item is quite clear. During the last 2 years, the British politicians have been trying to undo Montague's promise for another dole of reforms to be bestowed every 10 years till the British Treasury exhausts. We can see what they have decided about the future. Let me make it clear that we do not analyze these things to rejoice over the achievement, but to form a clear idea about our situation, so that we may enlighten the masses and prepare them for further struggle. For us, compromise never means surrender, but a step forward and some rest. That is all, and nothing else. Having discussed the present situation, let us proceed to discuss the future program and the line of action we ought to adopt. As I have already stated, for any revolutionary party, a definite program is very essential. For you must know that revolution means action. It means a change brought about deliberately by an organized and systematic work, as opposed to sudden and unorganized or spontaneous change or breakdown. And for the formulation of a program, one must necessarily study 1. The goal, 2. The premises from where we are to start, that is, the existing conditions, and 3. The course of action, that is, the means and methods. Unless one has a clear notion about these three factors, one cannot discuss anything about the program. We have discussed the present situation to some extent. The goal also has been slightly touched. We want a socialist revolution, the indispensable preliminary to which is the political revolution. That is what we want. The political revolution does not mean the transfer of state, or more crudely, the power from the hands of the British to the Indian, but to those Indians who are one with us as to the final goal, or to be more precise, the power to be transferred to the revolutionary party through popular support. After that, to proceed in right earnest is to organize the reconstruction of the whole society on the socialist basis. If you do not mean this revolution, then please have mercy. Stop shouting, "Long live the revolution." The term revolution is too sacred, at least to us, to be so lightly used or misused. But if you say you are for the national revolution and the aim of your struggle is an Indian republic of the type of the United States of America, then I ask you to please let known on what forces you rely that will help you bring about that revolution. Whether national or the socialist are the peasantry and the labor. Congress leaders do not dare to organize those forces. You have seen it in this movement. They know it better than anybody else, that without these forces, they are absolutely helpless. When they passed the resolution of complete independence, that really meant a revolution, they did not mean it. They had to do it under the pressure of the younger element, and then they wanted to use it as a threat to achieve their heart's desire, dominion status. You can easily judge it by studying the resolutions of the last 3 sessions of the Congress. I mean Madras, Calcutta, and Lahore. At Calcutta, they passed a resolution asking for dominion status within 12 months. Otherwise, they would be forced to adopt complete independence as their object, and in all solemnity, waited for some such gift till midnight of the 31st December 1929. Then they found themselves honor-bound to adopt the independence resolution. Otherwise, they did not mean it. But even then, Mahatma Ji made no secret of the fact that the door for compromise was open. That was the real spirit. At the very outset, they knew that their movement could not but end in some compromise. It is this half-heartedness that we hate, not the compromise at a particular stage in the struggle. Anyway, we were discussing the forces on which you can depend for a revolution. But if you say that you will approach the peasants and laborers to enlist their active support, let me tell you that they are not going to be fooled by any sentimental talk. They ask you quite candidly, what are they going to gain by your revolution for which you demand their sacrifices? What difference does it make to them whether Lord Reading is the head of the Indian government or Sir Purushottam Das Thakur Das? What difference for a peasant if Sir Tej Bahadur Sapru replaces Lord Irwin? It is useless to appeal to his national sentiment. You can't use him for your purpose. You shall have to mean seriously and to make him understand that the revolution is going to be his and for his good. The revolution of the proletariat and for the proletariat. When you have formulated this clear-cut idea about your goals, you can proceed in right earnest to organize your forces for such an action. Now there are two different phases through which you shall have to pass. First, the preparation, second, the action. After the present movement ends, you will find disgust and some disappointment amongst the sincere revolutionary workers. But you need not worry. Leave sentimentalism aside. Be prepared to face the facts. Revolution is a very difficult task. It is beyond the power of any man to make a revolution. Neither can it be brought about on any appointed date. It is brought about by special environments, social and economic. The function of an organized party is to utilize as such opportunity offered by these circumstances. And to prepare the masses and organize the forces for the revolution is a very difficult task. And that required a very great sacrifice on the part of the revolutionary workers. Let me make it clear that if you are a businessman or an established worldly or family man, please don't play with fire. As a leader, you are of no use to the party. We have already very many such leaders who spare some evening hours for delivering speeches. They are useless. We require, to use the term so dear to Lenin, the professional revolutionaries. The whole-time workers who have no other ambitions or life work except the revolution. The greater the number of such workers organized into a party, the greater the chances of your success. To proceed systematically, what you need the most is a party with workers of the type discussed above, with clear-cut ideas and keen perception and ability of initiative and quick decisions. The party shall have iron discipline, and it need not necessarily be an underground party, rather the contrary. Though the policy of voluntarily going to jail should altogether be abandoned, that will create a number of workers who shall be forced to lead an underground life. They should carry on the work with the same zeal, and it is this group of workers that shall produce worthy leaders for the real opportunity. The party requires workers which can be recruited only through the youth movement. Hence, we find the youth movement as the starting point of our program. The youth movement should organize study circles, class lectures, and publication of leaflets, pamphlets, books, and periodicals. This is the best recruiting and training ground for political workers. These young men, who may have matured their ideas and may find themselves ready to devote their life to the cause, may be transferred to the party. The party workers shall always guide and control the work of the youth movement as well. The party should start with the work of mass propaganda. It is very essential. One of the fundamental causes of the failure of the efforts of the Gadar Party, 1914 to 1915, was the ignorance, apathy, and sometimes active opposition of the masses. And apart from that, it is essential for gaining the active sympathy of and organizing the peasants and workers. This party of political workers, bound by strict discipline, should handle all other movements. It shall have to organize the peasants and workers' parties, labor unions, and kindred political bodies. And in order to create political consciousness, not only of national politics but class politics as well, the party should organize a big publishing campaign. Subjects on all proletons enlightening the masses of the socialist theory shall be within easy reach and distributed widely. The writings should be simple and clear. There are certain people in the labor movement who enlist some absurd ideas about the economic liberty of the peasants and workers without political freedom. They are demagogues or muddle-headed people. Such ideas are unimaginable and preposterous. We mean the economic liberty of the masses, and for that very purpose we are striving to win the political power. No doubt in the beginning we shall have to fight for little economic demands and privileges of these classes. But these struggles are the best means for educating them for a final struggle to conquer political power. Apart from these, there shall necessarily be organized a military department. This is very important. At times its need is felt very badly. But at that time you cannot start and formulate such a group with substantial means to act effectively. Perhaps this is the topic that needs careful explanation. There is very great probability of my being misunderstood on this subject. Apparently, I have acted like a terrorist. But I am not a terrorist. I am a revolutionary who has got such definite ideas of a lengthy program as is being discussed here. My comrades in arms might accuse me, like Ram Prasad Bismil, for having been subjected to certain sort of reaction in the condemned cell, which is not true. I have got the same ideas, same convictions, same zeal, and same spirit as I used to have outside. Perhaps, nay, decidedly better. Hence I warn my readers to be careful while reading my words. They should not try to read anything between the lines. Let me announce with all the strength at my command that I am not a terrorist and I never was, except perhaps in the beginning of my revolutionary career. And I am convinced that we cannot gain anything through those methods. One can easily judge it from the history of the Hindustan Socialist Republican Association. All our activities were directed towards an aim, that is, identifying ourselves with the great movement as its military wing. If anybody has misunderstood me, let him amend his ideas. I do not mean that bombs and pistols are useless, rather the contrary. But I mean to say that mere bomb throwing is not only useless, but sometimes harmful. The military department of the party should always keep ready all the war material it can command for any emergency. It should back the political work of the party. It cannot and should not work independently. On these lines indicated above, the party should proceed with its work. Through periodical meetings and conferences, they should go on educating and enlightening their workers on all topics. If you start the work on these lines, you shall have to be very sober. The program requires at least 20 years for its fulfillment. Cast aside the youthful dreams of a revolution within 10 years, of Gandhi's utopian promises of Swaraj in 1 year. It requires neither the emotion nor the death, but the life of constant struggle, suffering and sacrifice. Crush your individuality first. Shake off the dreams of personal comfort. Then start to work. Inch by inch, you shall have to proceed. It needs courage, perseverance, and very strong determination. No difficulties and no hardships shall discourage you. No failure and betrayals shall dishearten you. No travails imposed upon you shall snuff out the revolutionary will in you. Through the ordeal of sufferings and sacrifice, you shall come out victorious. And these individual victories shall be the valuable assets of the revolution. Long live the revolution. 2 February, 1931. Chapter 16. Line of Defense in Hari Kishan's Case. June 1931. On 23rd December 1930, when Governor of Punjab was leaving the University Hall, Lahore, after delivering his convocation address, Hari Kishan fired at him. One man died, and the governor was slightly injured. During the trial, Hari Kishan's defense counsel took the line that Hari Kishan had no intention to kill the governor and that he only wanted to give a warning. Bhagat Singh was opposed to this line of defense. He wrote to one of his friends about how revolutionary cases should be conducted. This letter was later published in June 1931. My strength is the strength of oppressed. My courage is the courage of desperation. Bhagat Singh. I am very sorry to note that my last letter in this connection did not reach its destination at the proper time and therefore could be of no use or failed to serve the purpose of which it was written. Hence, I write this letter to let you know my views on the question of defense in the political cases in general, and the revolutionary cases in particular. Apart from certain points already discussed in that letter, it shall serve another purpose too. It shall be a documentary proof that I am not becoming wise after the event. Anyhow, I wrote in that letter that the plea that the lawyer was suggesting to offer defense should not be adopted. But it has been done, in spite of your and my opposition. Nevertheless, we can now discuss the matter in a better light and can formulate definitive ideas about the future policy regarding defense. You know that I have never been in favor of defending all the political accused. But this does not imply that the beauty of the real struggle should be altogether spoiled. Please note that the term beauty is not used in the abstract sense, but it means the motive that actuated a particular action. When I say that all the politicals should always defend themselves, I say it with certain reservations. It can be cleared by just one explanation. A man does an act with a certain end in view. After his arrest, the political significance of the action should not be diminished. The perpetrator should not become more important than the action itself. Let us further elucidate it with the help of the illustration. Mr. Hari Kishan came to shoot the governor. I don't want to discuss the ethical side of the action. I want only to discuss the political side of the case. The man was arrested. Unfortunately, some police official had died in the action. Now comes the question of the defense. Well, when fortunately the governor had escaped, there could be a very beautiful statement in his case. That is the statement of actual facts as was made in the lower court. And it would have served the legal purpose too. The wisdom and ability of the lawyer depended on his interpretation of the cause of the sub-inspector's death. What did he gain by saying that he did not intend to kill the governor and only wanted to warn him, and all that sort of thing? Can any sensible man imagine even for a moment the possibility of such a design? Had it any legal value? Absolutely none. Then what was the use of spoiling the beauty of not only the particular action, but also the general movement? Warning and futile protests cannot go on forever. The warning has once been given long ago. The revolutionary struggle had begun in right earnest, so far as the strength of the revolutionary party allowed. Viceroy's train action was neither a test nor a warning. Similarly, Mr. Hari Kishan's action was part of the struggle itself, not a warning. After the failure of the action, the accused can take it in a sportsmanlike spirit. The purpose having been served, he ought to have rejoiced in the lucky escape of the governor. There is no use of killing any one individual. These actions have their political significance in as much as they serve to create a mentality and an atmosphere which shall be very necessary to the final struggle. That is all. Individual actions are to win the moral support of the people. We sometimes designate them as propaganda through deed. Now the people should be defended, but subject to the above consideration. This is, after all, a common principle that all the contending parties always try to gain more and lose less. No general can ever adopt a policy in which he may have to make a greater sacrifice than the gain expected. Nobody would be more anxious to save the precious life of Mr. Hari Kishan than myself. But I want to let you know that the thing which makes his life precious should by no means be ignored. To save the lives at any cost is not our policy. It may be the policy of the easy chair politicians, but it is not ours. Much of the defense policy depends upon the mentality of the accused himself. But if the accused himself is not only afraid of shrinking, but is as enthusiastic as ever, then his work for which he risked his life should be considered first, his personal question afterwards. Again, there may be some sort of confusion. There may be cases where the action is of no general importance in spite of its tremendous local value. There the accused should not be sentimental as to admit the responsibility. The famous trial of Nirmal Kant Rai would be the best illustration. But in cases like this, where it is of such political importance, the personal aspect should not be attached to greater value than the political one. If you want to know my frank opinion about his case, let me tell you frankly that it is nothing short of the political murder of an incident of historic importance at the altar of professional legal vanity. Here I may point out one thing more, that the people responsible for this strangulation of the case, having realized their blunder and having become wise after the event in not daring to shoulder their responsibility, are trying to belittle the beauty of the marvelous character of our young comrade. I have heard them saying that Mr. Hari Kishan shirked to face it boldly. This is a most shamefaced lie. He is the most courageous lad I have ever come across. People should have mercy upon us. Better ignored than demoralized and degraded, but well looked after. Lawyers should not be so unscrupulous as to exploit the one and even deaths of young people who come to sacrifice themselves for so noble a cause as the emancipation of the suffering humanity. Otherwise, why should a lawyer demand such an incredible fee as he has been paid in the above case? In the sedition cases, I may tell you the limit to which we can allow the defense. Last year, when one comrade was prosecuted for having delivered a socialistic speech, and when he pleaded not guilty to that charge, we were simply astounded. In such cases, we should demand the right of free speech. But where such things are attributed to one, as he has not said, and are contrary to the interests of the movement, deny. Though in the present movement, the Congress has suffered for having allowed its members to go to jail without defending themselves, in my opinion, that was a mistake. Anyhow, I think if you read this letter along with my previous one, you will come to know very clearly my ideas about the defense in political cases. In Mr. Hari Kishan's case, in my opinion, his appeal should be filed in the High Court without fail, and every effort should be made to save him. I hope both these letters indicate everything I want to say on this subject. Chapter 17. Introduction to the Dreamland. When his friend Lala Ram Charan Das requested him to write an introduction to his collection of poems, Bhagat Singh penned down the following. Lovers, lunatics, and poets are made of the same stuff. Bhagat Singh, my noble friend, L. Ram Charan Das has asked me to write an introduction to his poetical work, The Dreamland. I am neither a poet nor a literature expert. Neither am I a journalist nor a critic. Hence, by no stretch of imagination can I find the justification of the demand. But the circumstances in which I am placed do not afford any opportunity of discussing the question with the author, arguing back and forth, and thereby do not leave me any alternative but to comply with the desire of my friend. As I am not a poet, I am not going to discuss it from that point of view. I have absolutely no knowledge of meter, and do not even know whether judged from metrical standard, it would prove correct. Not being from literature, I am not going to discuss it with a view of assigning to it its right place in the national literature. I, being a political worker, can at the utmost discuss it only from that point of view. But here also one factor is making my work practically impossible, or at least very difficult. As a rule, the introduction is always written by a man who is at one with the author on the contents of the work. But here the case is quite different. I do not see eye to eye with my friend on all the matters. He was aware of the fact that I differed from him on many vital points. Therefore, my writing is not going to be an introduction at all. It can at the utmost amount to a criticism, and its place will be at the end and not in the beginning of the book. In the political field, the Dreamland occupies a very important place. In the prevailing circumstance, it is filling up a very important gap in the movement. As a matter of fact, all the political movements of our country that have hitherto played any important role in our modern history had been lacking the ideal at the achievement of which they aimed. Revolutionary movement is no exception. In spite of all my efforts, I could not find any revolutionary party that had clear ideas as to what they were fighting for, with the exception of the Ghadar Party, which, having been inspired by the USA form of government, clearly stated that they wanted to replace the existing government by a Republican form of government. All other parties consisted of men who had but one idea, that is to fight against the alien rulers. That idea is quite laudable, but cannot be termed a revolutionary idea. We must make it clear that revolution does not merely mean an upheaval or a sanguinary strife. Revolution necessarily implies the program of systematic reconstruction of society on new and better adapted basis after complete destruction of the existing state of affairs, that is, regime. In the political field, the liberals wanted some reform under the present government, while the extremists demanded a bit more and were prepared to employ radical means for the same purpose. Among the revolutionaries, they had always been in favor of extreme methods with one idea, that is of overthrowing the foreign domination. No doubt, there had been some who were in favor of extorting some reforms through those means. All these movements cannot rightly be designated as revolutionary movement. But L. Ram Charan Das is the first revolutionary recruited formally in the Punjab by a Bengali absconder in 1908. Since then, he had been in touch with the revolutionary movements and finally joined the Ghadar party, but retaining his old ideas that people held about the ideal of their movement. It has another interesting fact to add to its beauty and value. L. Ram Charan Das was sentenced to death in 1915, and the sentence was later on commuted to life transportation. Today, sitting in the condemned cells myself, I can let the readers know as authoritatively that the life imprisonment is comparatively a far harder lot than that of death. L. Ram Charan Das had actually to undergo 14 years of imprisonment. It was in some southern jail that he wrote this poetry. The then psychology and mental struggle of the author has stamped its impressions upon the poetry and makes it all the more beautiful and interesting. He had been struggling hard against some depressing mood before he decided to write. In the days when many of his comrades had been let off on undertakings and the temptation had been very strong for everyone and for him, and when the sweet and painful memories of wife and children had added more to the work. Hence, we find the sudden outburst in the opening paragraph, "Wife, children, friends that me surround were poisonous snakes all around." He discusses philosophy in the beginning. This philosophy is the backbone of all the revolutionary movement of Bengal as well as of the Punjab. I differ from him on this point very widely. His interpretation of the universe is teleological and metaphysical, while I am a materialist and my interpretation of the phenomenon would be casual. Nevertheless, it is by no means out of place or out of date. The general ideals that are prevailing in our country are more in accordance with those expressed by him. To fight that depressing mood, he resorted to prayers, as is evident that the whole of the beginning of the book is devoted to God, his praise, his definition. Belief in God is the outcome of mysticism, which is the natural consequence of depression. That this world is Maya or Mithya, a dream or a fiction, is clear mysticism which has been originated and developed by Hindu sages of old ages, such as Shankaracharya and others. But in the materialist philosophy, this mode of thinking has got absolutely no place. But this mysticism of the author is by no means ignoble or deplorable. It has its own idea of them doing very productive labor. The only difference that the socialist society expects is that the mental workers shall no longer be regarded superior to the manual workers. L. Ram Charan Das's idea about free education is really worth considering, and the socialist government has adopted somewhat the same course in Russia. His discussion about crime is really the most advanced school of thought. Crime is the most serious social problem which needs a very tactful treatment. He has been in jail for the better part of his life. He has got the practical experience. At one place he employs the typical jail terms, the light labor, the medium labor, and the hard labor, etc. Like all other socialists, he suggests that instead of retribution, that is retaliation, the reformative theory should form the basis of punishment. Not to punish, but to reclaim should be the guiding principle of the administration of justice. Jails should be reformatories and not veritable hells. In this connection, the readers should study the Russian prison system. While dealing with militia, he discusses war as well. In my opinion, War, as an institution, shall only occupy a few pages in the encyclopedia then, and war materials shall adorn the no conflicting or diverse interests that cause war. At the utmost, we can say that war shall have to be retained as an institution for the transitional period. We can easily understand if we take the example of the present-day Russia. There is the dictatorship of the proletariat at present. They want to establish a socialist society. Meanwhile, they have to maintain an army to defend themselves against the capitalist society. But the war aims would be different. Imperialist designs shall no more actuate our dreamland people to wage wars. There shall be no more war trophies. The revolutionary armies shall march to other lands to bring rulers down from their thrones and stop their blood-sucking exploitation, and thus to liberate the toiling masses. But there shall not be the primitive national or racial hatred to goad our men to fight. World Federation is the most popular and immediate object of all the free-thinking people, and the author has well dilated on the subject, and his criticism of the so-called League of Nations is beautiful. In a footnote under stanza 571-572, the author touches, though briefly, the question of methods. He says, "Such a kingdom cannot be brought about by physical violent revolutions. It cannot be forced upon society from without. It must grow from within. This can be brought about by the gradual process of evolution, by educating the masses on the lines mentioned above, etc." This statement does not in itself contain any discrepancy. It is quite correct, but having not been fully explained, is liable to create some misunderstanding, or worse still, a confusion. Does it mean that L. Ram Charan Das has realized the futility of the cult of force? Has he become an orthodox believer in nonviolence? No, it does not mean that. Let me explain what the above-quoted statement amounts to. The revolutionaries know better than anybody else that the socialist society cannot be brought about by violent means, but that it should grow and evolve from within. The author suggests education as the only weapon to be employed. But everybody can easily realize that the present government here, or as a matter of fact, all the capitalist governments are not only not going to help any such effort, but on the contrary, suppress it mercilessly. Then what will his evolution achieve? We, the revolutionaries, are striving to capture power in our hands and to organize a revolutionary government which should employ all its resources for mass education, as is being done in Russia today. After capturing power, peaceful methods shall be employed for constructive work. Force shall be employed to crush the obstacles. If that is what the author means, then we are at one. And I am confident that it is exactly this that he means. I have discussed the book at great length. I have rather criticized it. But I am not going to ask any alteration in it, because this has got its historical value. These were the ideas of 1914-15 revolutionaries. I strongly recommend this book to young men in particular, but with a warning. Please do not read it to follow blindly and take for granted what is written in it. Read it, criticize it, think over it, and try to formulate your own ideas with its help. Chapter 18. Don't hang us, shoot us. 1931. Bhagat Singh's last letter of petition, to expedite the order of his execution. I am such a lunatic that I am free even in jail. Bhagat Singh. To the Punjab Governor. Sir, with due respect, we beg to bring to your kind notice the following: that we were sentenced to death on 7th October 1930 by a British court, LCC tribunal, constituted under the Special Lahore Conspiracy Case Ordinance, promulgated by the H.E. the Viceroy, the head of the British Government of India, and that the main charge against us was that of having waged war against H.M. King George, the King of England. The above-mentioned finding of the court presupposed two things. Firstly, that there exists a state of war between the British nation and the Indian nation. And secondly, that we had actually participated in that war and were therefore war prisoners. The second presupposition seems to be a little bit flattering, but nevertheless, it is too tempting to resist the desire of acquiescing in it. As regards the first, we are constrained to go into some detail. Apparently, there seems to be no such war as the phrase indicates. Nevertheless, please allow us to accept the validity of the presupposition, taking it at its face value. But in order to be correctly understood, we must explain it further. Let us declare that the state of war does exist and shall exist so long as the Indian toiling masses and the natural resources are being exploited by a handful of parasites. They may be purely British capitalist or mixed British and Indian, or even purely Indian. They may be carrying on their insidious exploitation through mixed or even on purely Indian bureaucratic apparatus. All these things make no difference. No matter, if your government tries and succeeds in winning over the leaders of the upper strata of the Indian society through petty concessions and compromises, and thereby cause a temporary demoralization in the main body of the forces. No matter, if once again the vanguard of the Indian movement, the Revolutionary Party, finds itself deserted in the thick of the war. No matter if the leaders to whom personally we are much indebted for the sympathy and feelings they expressed for us, but nevertheless we cannot overlook the fact that they did become so callous as to ignore and not to make a mention in the peace negotiation of even the homeless, friendless, and penniless of female workers who are alleged to be belonging to the vanguard, and whom the leaders consider to be enemies of their utopian, non-violent cult, which has already become a thing of the past. The heroines who had ungrudgingly sacrificed or offered for sacrifice their husbands, brothers, and all that were nearest and dearest to them, including themselves, whom your government has declared to be outlaws. No matter if your agents stoop so low as to fabricate baseless calumnies against their spotless characters to damage their and their party's reputation, the war shall continue. It may assume different shapes at different times. It may become now open, now hidden, now purely agitational, now fierce life and death struggle. The choice of the course, whether bloody or comparatively peaceful, which it should adopt rests with you. Choose whichever you like, but that war shall be incessantly waged without taking into consideration the petty and the meaningless ethical ideologies. It shall be waged ever with new vigor, greater audacity, and unflinching determination till the socialist republic is established, and the present social order is completely replaced by a new social order, based on social prosperity. And thus every sort of exploitation is put an end to, and the humanity is ushered into the era of genuine and permanent peace. In the very near future, the final battle shall be fought, and final settlement arrived at. The days of capitalist and imperialist exploitation are numbered. The war neither began with us, nor is it going to end with our lives. It is the inevitable consequence of the historic events and the existing environments. Our humble sacrifices shall be only a link in the chain that has very accurately been beautified by the unparalleled sacrifice of Mr. Das, and most tragic but noblest sacrifice of Comrade Bhagwati Charan, and the glorious death of our dear warrior Azad. As to the question of our fates, please allow us to say that when you have decided to put us to death, you will certainly do it. You have got the power in your hands, and power is the greatest justification in this world. We know that the maxim, might is right, serves as your guiding motto. The whole of our trial was just a proof of that. We wanted to point out that according to the verdict of your court, we had waged war and were therefore war prisoners, and we claim to be treated as such. That is, we claim to be shot dead instead of to be hanged. It rests with you to prove that you really meant what your court has said. We request and hope that you will very kindly order the military department to send its detachment to perform our execution. Yours, Bhagat Singh.
This has been a production of Why I Am an Atheist and Other Works.
written by Bhagat Singh.